I have at home a very beautiful daughter who is 19 years of age and who very early in her life discovered that her calling was keeping me humble. And she often does it, but she did it again as I was preparing for this conference. She went through the leaflet advertising the conference. She looked at all the other fellows who were speaking and studied their credentials and looked at their smooth city appearance against my rather bushy one, and she said, "Dad, how come you're speaking at that conference?" And I said, "Well, I'm speaking there because I've been invited." And she said, "Well, it really amazes me that a farmer with no qualifications can go to a conference like that." So she keeps me humble, and she's right, of course. I'm a farmer with no qualifications. But I guess that some years ago the Lord led me in his graciousness into a counselling ministry, and I was applying for membership in association the other day, and I had to prove that I'd had 900 hours of counselling experience. So I went through my diaries in 10 years and found that I'd averaged nearly 1,500 hours a year. So that's a fair bit of counselling, and I suddenly felt like a holiday after that, and still feel like that. But much of those hours in the last few years have been spent with missionaries and pastors and evangelists and counselors who have been in Christian work for a long time and who have come to a point in their lives that they would describe as burnout or brokenness or barrenness. And I have a tremendous concern for that sort of a problem. I've been there myself some 6 years ago. I know what it is to suffer burnout. And I have a tremendous burden on my heart for people who are ministering for God out of a state of brokenness. And I want to share with you just a few things out of that, and it won't be terribly scholarly. I have no idea what you expect from the subject on your program. But what I want to talk about is this whole subject of wholeness, wholeness, and brokenness as it applies first to the world to which we preach, and then as it applies to us as those who do preach. I want to be as direct as I can and as personal as I can, and if I do nothing more than raise questions that causes you to go back and work on them, then I will have achieved what I have set out to do. I set out to try and define wholeness, and the definition that I have come up with is probably an inadequate one, but at least it's one that we want to start with today. Wholeness is a process toward a state of well-being in which the negative influences of the past are denied their authority and God presences himself through inner healing and reveals himself through the fruit of the Spirit. I don't know how you feel about that. I'd like you to wrestle with it. But as we've been listening to the reminder that we need to be careful of adding to the gospel or taking away from the gospel, it seems appropriate that I should encourage you to explore the fullness of the redemptive act of Christ. He has come to call a broken world and a broken people into wholeness. When we preach the gospel, we preach the gospel to people who are living in a state of brokenness. People who've been through broken relationships, people who've been through negative traumatic experiences in their life, people who know what it is to be rejected, who've been through depression, who've been through chronic illnesses, who've never really risen above those things, and so are living out their lives in a state of brokenness dictated to by the powers of the past. I talk to people all the time whose problems in the present are a direct result of being ruled over by memories and incidents and traumatic experiences of sometimes the distant past, 20, 30 years. I remember a very gracious Christian lady who went through very deep depression, quite regularly. A woman who was involved very deeply in Christian ministry, sitting, talking to me one time, and we were exploring the basis of her depression. And I found that, like many, many middle-aged women that I talk to these days, her depression was rooted in the experience of incest as a little child. In the 40s, it seemed that that was a pretty common event. And as we touched on that and we uncovered that, this sweet, smiling lady suddenly became a raging tornado as all the anger and malice and resentment and guilt that she carried in her life for some 30-odd years burst out. But the thing was, brothers and sisters, that that anger and that malice and that resentment had dominated her life all that time. The fact that she was able to suppress it, the fact that she was able to sit on it, did not mean it wasn't having a very dynamic, destructive effect in her life. And although she was preaching wholeness, she was living in a state of brokenness. Because the memory and the experience and the bitterness and the anger was what now influenced her in how she felt about men, or how she felt about herself, or how she felt about sexuality, or how she felt about womanhood. And she couldn't preach about those things or teach about them or relate in the normal family relationships without it plunging her into despair. That in modern psychological terms, we call depression. I want to suggest to you today that wholeness is a process, as my definition says. It's not just a state of perfection, it's a process in which I have a process I've begun by denying the influence of the past on my life. In Philippians chapter 3, Paul speaks about gaining Christ, knowing him today. And he says, in order to do that, I need to strip the past of its significance. I need to forget those things which are behind and press forward to the things that are before. I need to count the past as loss that I might gain Christ. It's a beautiful principle, isn't it? But many people have enshrined their memories and enshrined their experiences and haven't begun the process. I think it's important too for us to define today what the negative influences of the past are and to answer the question, do we all need to be healed? Now, I want to suggest to you that most of us, no matter how good a parents we had, most of us are at some point or other the victim of faulty parenting. Now, I'm sorry about that because most of you are parents too, and that it follows that your kids are victims of faulty parenting as well. At some point in our parenting, we've all failed. Probably because our concept of loving or our concept of Christianity or our concept of service has been screwy at some point. Maybe I have grown up in a situation where a mother has seen love as being a dominating thing that has brought out her superiority over me as a child and has caused her to rule me with a rod of iron, not because the Bible says spare the rod and spoil the child, but because it suits her personality not to spare the rod. And I have been brought up in that sort of environment. Or maybe I've been brought up in an environment with an absent father. I well remember a preacher's son who told me once that his, the only time his father seemed to take any notice of him was when he was in the pulpit and found it necessary to say something nice about his family. He said, my father was always a distant person, a distant figure on the other side of the credibility gap, he said, between what he preached and what he was prepared to do. And some of us have grown up in an environment with an absent father, or a weak father maybe, who was never able to assert himself in the family. And some of us have been through experiences of rejection, and we know the pain of not being loved, or feeling that we were not being loved. And some of us have grown up through the struggles that we've had with our parents over independence. And we felt hurt and misunderstood and bitter and angry about that. Now, I'm not suggesting tonight, today, that we hang the blame for the sort of persons we are on our parents. What I am saying is that we often carry the bruises of that, and we have formed feelings and thoughts about that for which we are now responsible. But it came out of our experiences, and many of us do need to be healed, and perhaps all of us need to be healed in some area of our life. And I ask the question under 2.4, can preachers live in a state of brokenness? And my answer is yes, they can, and yes, they do. I know I have met people who have served on the mission field who have carried with them tremendous pain all their lives and have reflected that in their work by being withdrawn, by being often depressed, by being afraid to share themselves, by building defense mechanisms around them so people have never really got to know them. Being a preacher can be a pretty handy thing when it comes to wanting to keep people outside of our lives. When I was 5 years of age, I went through a very traumatic experience that related to a school teacher. And I carried the pain of that till I was 38. And it influenced me in many, many ways. I was a very angry person, and I expressed that anger in all sorts of ways, even though I was a preacher and a counselor. It wasn't until I worked through the healing of that that I realized how much I had reflected that on my family. And the counselor who helped me at the time looked at me and said, "Graham, my feelings about you is that you have a very public area of your life which you share very openly, but you have a private area of your life that you have built a 10-foot fence around, and there isn't any way anybody's going to get in." And he said, "In fact, that's probably one of the reasons you're a preacher, because you can stand up in the pulpit 6 foot above contradiction and keep everybody at a distance. You can have a plethora of contacts but no real friends." Now, I don't know whether he was right or not, but I'm sure that it's possible to be like that. In fact, it's a good thing to ask ourselves today whether we really do have many friends, people who really do know us, people who we've had the courage to let in to our lives in any real sense at all. Many of us have roadblocks to wholeness, very deep roadblocks to wholeness. And I want to talk about some of those today. Let me just, before I do that, just take as an illustration, an example, the example of anger. Now, lots of people, most Christians, would not admit to being angry. In fact, I sometimes have a lot of fun with that. When I'm counselling a person and I identify some anger in the person, I say, "It sounds to me as if you're angry." And they say, "No, not angry, just a little annoyed." They say, "Well, you sound very annoyed." And they say, "Well, not very annoyed, just sort of irritated." And they will use every word other than angry, because we've got this feeling that Christians never are angry. We never are hostile. But many people have to come back to recognize that there is a good reason to stay angry. Have you ever been angry without being justified? Of course I've got a right to be angry. He hurt me. I'm justified, right? And there are good reasons for staying angry. I stay angry because I want to see the hurter suffer for what he's done to me. I want to get some revenge. I'm being angry when I hold someone else under an obligation to suffer for their sin against me. Or I might stay angry to protect myself from getting hurt in the future. Resentment's a really handy thing at keeping people at a distance. Or I might get angry because to forgive seems unfair when it is really someone else's fault. And so whether I call it anger or resentment or just being careful, I have enshrined an emotional response to something that has happened in the past. The lack of dealing with hurt through the application of the principle of forgiving others as God in Christ has forgiven you is one of the most common phenomena in the church. We preach about forgiveness, we've got the greatest model of forgiveness, but we know very little about it. I hear Christians say, I can never forgive her. I could never forgive him. I meet Christians in churches who have not spoken to each other for years since the last confrontation. I have met Christians of the same family serving God in full-time work in different parts of Australia who haven't spoken to each other for years. Since there was a confrontation over father's will or some other family situation. Forgiveness is something we know about and we preach about, but we find very great difficulty in doing. Forgiveness brings freedom, a freedom to live and a freedom to love, but a lack of forgiveness can be the basis for debilitating conditions like depression and stress and back complaints and migraines and many other serious problems with which people wrestle today. Criticism and cynicism and sarcasm are often the product of internalized anger. And even mature Christians, brothers and sisters, excuse such behaviours as criticism and cynicism and sarcasm and aggressiveness and withdrawal on the basis of that's my personality. Me dad was like that. So I've inherited it. Instead of laying the blame where it really lies, and that is in this whole business of undealt with emotional hurt. The appropriate response, and I say this to you as preachers and you know it well, the appropriate response to anger is to apply the principle of forgiveness to the root cause of the anger. As Christian leaders, we must do this in our own lives, and as evangelists, we must encourage others to do it. We must encourage new converts to put aside bitterness, put away bitterness, and rage and anger and brawling and slander, as Paul says in Ephesians, along with every other form of malice, forgiving one another just as God in Christ forgave you. I guess a point I'm making, and you may struggle with this theologically, but my point is that people are not made whole simply by making a decision at an evangelistic meeting. They are not made whole simply by being converted. Something else has to happen. In Colossians chapter 3, Paul tackles this problem when he reminds us that we have been raised with Christ and that we have died and that our life is hidden with Christ in God, and that when Christ, who is our life, appears, then we'll also appear with him in glory. But then he adds, put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature. Brokenness is a result of failing to put off. It is the end result of being lorded over by maverick emotions, past experiences, and wrong thinking, all of which need to be specifically repented of. If then, as my definition of wholeness states, if it's progressively achieved by denying the negative influences, their authority over us, then it is the recognition and the renunciation of those negative influences that begins the process, right? It's not just simply by declaring myself saved or moving through a conversion experience. It's by an actual renunciation of the authority that those past hurts have over me that I begin the process. It's a believing that Christ has not only died for my sin, but he has died for every sin committed against me. It's the application of that truth to my life that begins me on the process of wholeness. I need to pause here and express my concern that much counselling at evangelistic meetings and rallies leaves much to be desired. I remember being present once at a great teaching and preaching event where there are some 3,000 young people, and on the Saturday evening there was going to be a big evangelistic rally. They expected, on past experience, hundreds to respond. And that's pretty exciting, and in fact that did happen. But on the morning before that event, they asked those who had been involved in counselling before to stay behind and to be briefed on the process of what was going to go on in the evening meeting. So I went up to see what went on, and I sat beside a girl who quickly told me that just that week she had come out of a psychiatric hospital. She was pregnant to a man who was not her husband, with whom she was living. She had what I could clearly see to be very deep psychotic problems, and she was about that night to counsel a newborn child of God. And it wrenched my heart to wonder how many people living, brothers and sisters, in a state of brokenness attempt and are allowed to attempt to counsel in evangelistic rallies people who've come to Christ. Can you imagine that girl being able to help a girl work through a sexual problem, or a relationship problem, or a hate problem, when she's as twisted and as broken as that? She needed counselling, not by a Christian counsellor, but a psychiatrist. She needed hospitalisation, she needed deep help, but she was there, given a kit, and given permission to counsel somebody. Now I just simply want to say this, that if it's important that those who are at our evangelistic missions are going to counsel out of a state of wholeness, it's even more important that those of us who proclaim the message proclaim it out of the same state of wholeness. But how are we to assess our state of wholeness? And I suggest we need to address this matter next, and we need to be sure that we are daily denying the authority of the negative influences of the past in our own lives. And in order to be sure that we're doing that, we need to answer some questions. And I want to ask you three questions, and I ask myself the same questions. The first one is, am I guilt motivated? Many Christian leaders are more driven by guilt than by nobler motivations. Guilt, usually the kind that is projected on us by others, forces us to respond in the affirmative to every request for help, makes us afraid to disappoint any person who's certain expectations of us. I remember an occasion when my wife and I had had a very busy week, and we were both very tired, and I came home one evening from work and I said, "Julie, look, it's Bible study night tonight, but let's stay home tonight. We've earned a night off." And Julie said, "Hey, that's a good idea." When we sat down for tea, she said to me, Do you know the prayer meeting tonight is in the home of someone that hasn't had it there before? I have the feeling that maybe there won't be many people there tonight. Perhaps we should go. And I said, no, I've made up my mind. We're staying home. She said, that's a good idea. 7 o'clock, she looked out the window and it was raining and doing everything possible, as you can imagine if you know Mary's villain. And she said, oh, it's a dirty night. There's not many, won't be many people out tonight. Perhaps we should go. And I said, no, honey, I've made up my mind. We're going to sit home by the fire and we're going to really enjoy ourselves tonight. She said, good idea. At 7:55, I said, get your coat. We're going to the prayer meeting. Guilt had got to me in the end. And we both sat in that prayer meeting that night, really angry that we'd come. There were plenty there. Biggest prayer meeting for some time. We weren't there because we had a desire to pray. All we wanted to do was be home, sitting by the fire, making up for lost time. But out of guilt, we were there. And it made me ponder when we got home how often I did things more because of guilt than because Christ had motivated me to do it. I wondered how often I had said yes to the person who demanded to be talked to now, more out of the fear that if I didn't talk to them, they might think something nasty about me, than I did because I really had a sense of compassion for them. And I just want you to think about that too. Am I guilt motivated? Where did some of this guilt come from? I want to suggest that at the root of most cases of burnout amongst Christian workers is this whole business of guilt. Not only the projected guilt that drives us to work harder, but also the guilt that I feel as I grapple with the difference between what people see me to be and what I know myself to be. People have an image of us out there. They see us as confident, victorious, compassionate, indestructible, as altogether persons. They do not see what I feel. They do not see what my family sees. They know nothing of the anxiety that eats at us when we face a crisis, or the pain we feel when our fragile ego takes a battering from criticisms or poor results. The people out there know little of our vulnerability, our struggle with self-discipline, our moods, our times of depression, and our fears. They see us only as we project ourselves. Hence the guilt. Because what they see and what we see are often two different things. And often as Christian leaders, we do not have people who know us well, other than our wife and our family. And we have to live with that. And sometimes we will go to all sorts of extravagant, emotional ways of building fences so that people won't know exactly the struggles that I have. What struggles I have with relating to the people who are closest to me. What struggles I have with my own sexuality. What struggles I have with my own thought life. We don't always admit to having those. It's a pity, really, that we don't admit to having them. People would understand our message a lot more clearly when they saw it was coming out of earthly vessels than they do when they think it comes out of an angelic one. But then there's always the problem, if they were to find out what I was really like, would they still pray for me? And would they still send their weekly support? Have I really got the right to be an evangelist when I'm so human? And these questions might go on unconsciously. We might never think about them. But just as unknowingly, we strengthen our defences, our behaviour patterns, which in the end are more the fruit of brokenness than they are the fruit of wholeness. And behaviour patterns are the sign of brokenness. It's our families who sense our brokenness first. They are often the victims of our constant irritability, our times of silence, our sudden mood changes. It is often our wife, the person we love most, who begins to sense the loneliness that comes from running second to our ministry. And she's often forced into a struggle against resentment about that. Adults whom I have counseled who have grown up in preachers' families have often summed up the ill health of their father in comments like, "Even when he was home, he wasn't really there. The only time he ever said a nice thing about me was from the pulpit. I long for the day that he would play football or cricket with me, or just sit on my bed, but it never came." Or the saddest comment I've ever heard: "The man they eulogized at his funeral was certainly married to my mother, but he wasn't the father I knew." Wow. Among the behaviour patterns most frequently used to hide what I believe myself to be are withdrawal, excessive dominance — you like to write them down — withdrawal, drawing back into my shell, excessive dominance, taking total control of situations and not allowing anybody else to do it, phony humour. Sorry about that. But it is true that some of us keep people at a distance by being funny all the time. Excessive submission, being the doormat, letting people walk all over me. Depression. Aloofness. And subjective defensiveness, being really defensive and sensitive about everything that ever happens. These are all guilt-orientated behaviours, and I frequently find them amongst Christian workers. So the first question I need to ask myself is, am I guilt-orientated? And the second question I must ask myself is, have I or do I internalise anger? "Be angry and sin not," Paul says in Ephesians 4. Anger itself is neither right nor wrong. It's simply an involuntary expression of feeling like joy or sadness. It is what ultimately I do with my anger that makes it right or wrong. If I express my anger in a way that destroys another one's character, then I've expressed anger sinfully. If I suppress my anger so it begins to hurt me or my relationship with God or others, then I have still expressed it angrily. There is only one way to deal with anger, and that's to confess it, to express it in a way that accepts responsibility for my feeling, but doesn't destroy or hurt others. Internalized anger is primarily a sin against God because it constitutes a refusal to be obedient by forgiving others. And it's a sin against ourselves because it is a deliberate choice to live in a state of bitterness and resentment. Now, I don't know why I felt I had to labour this a bit today, except that experience teaches me that there are many Christian workers who carry bitterness and resentment that's undealt with. Common anger-orientated attitudes — and this might be interesting to write down too — common anger-orientated attitudes are being resentful, being critical, being sarcastic, self-rejecting, suspicious, overly sensitive, fearful, and superior or inferior. attitudes which come out of anger. The next question we need to address ourselves to today is, how do I attain wholeness? If I live in a state of brokenness, how do I begin the process? It seems to me that whether we are making the transition from a state of brokenness to wholeness for the first time, or whether I am simply removing a roadblock to wholeness as part of the daily process, the steps are the same. For what we must succeed in doing is to deal with negative emotion or memory that is likely to leave me imprisoned in guilt or anger. And I want to give you 5 steps for dealing with hurt or with negative emotions. 5 steps. I won't speak too much about them, just give them to you. The first one is that we must identify and own negative emotions. This is the most difficult of all, really, because it's much easier, and dare I say more natural, to blame others. To accept responsibility for what I feel, it's really hard work. If I go back to my lady who suffered with so much depression and most of her internalized anger was rooted to the incest situation, when I suggested to her that that was the problem, I had to get ready to duck, because immediately she thought I was blaming her. And I said, hey, it's not a matter of blame. The issue is not who's to blame for what happened. The issue is who's responsible for what's happening now. That's the issue. Who's responsible for the resentment and the bitterness and the anger now? And of course she is. And she must accept responsibility for that. We need to own and identify our own negative emotions. And secondly, the second step, is that we should list the damage you have done to yourself and others through attitudes or behavior that come out of past hurts. List the damage you have done to yourself and others through attitudes or behavior rooted in past hurts. Sometimes we think this matter of forgiveness is a matter of us getting spiritual enough to forgive others. But you know what it really is? It's recognizing how totally I've been forgiven and then reflecting it to someone else. Isn't that what Jesus taught in that beautiful story of the ungrateful servant? The guy that was forgiven that great debt. But I want you to remember something when you read that story. He went to the king with a speech made up. And his speech said, please postpone my debt. And when the king said, no, I won't, I'll cancel it, I don't really think he even heard that. I really think he went out of that room believing that all the king had done was to postpone the debt. And that's why he made the other guy pay up. But God has cancelled our debt. God has forgiven our sin. God has set us free in order what? That we might forgive others as Christ has forgiven us. Same way. But first of all, I need to experience God's forgiveness. I need to experience God's forgiveness for the people I've hurt out of my own anger, for the people I've cut off, for the people I've rejected, for the people I've hurt because of my attitudes, for the people I've hurt because I went silent when I should have communicated, for the people I hurt because I criticized them or put them down, for the wife that I've hurt because I've been too wrapped up in my own self to realize that she was hurting and needed to be loved. And then the third step is to forgive those with whom you have been angry. Forgive those with whom you have been angry. I just shared with you a truth that I think is the most beautiful and liberating truth I've ever discovered. And I discovered it some years ago. And it was this: Christ not only died for the sins which I have committed, but for every sin which has ever been committed against me. If that is true, I am no longer justified in staying angry or withholding forgiveness from the person who has hurt me. If Christ has paid the price, then on the basis of Christ's death and on the basis of that alone, I can forgive every man, every woman who's ever hurt me, whether that was in the past or whether that happened 5 minutes ago. And the fourth step is to ask God to enable you to replace negative emotions with the will to love. With the will to love. And I've given you a definition of love that I discovered the other day in a book written by Scott Peck. I'd never heard of the guy before, but he apparently was an agnostic psychiatrist who shortly after writing this book became a Christian. And the whole book is based on the fact that as a psychiatrist, he was coming to realize that most emotional illness was the result of faulty views of love. And later on, after he'd written the book, he came to Christ. But the definition is one that's worth pondering. Love is the will to extend oneself for the purpose of nurturing one's own or another's spiritual growth. It's not a feeling. It's not something that's romantic. It's not dependence. It's not self-sacrifice. It's the will to extend oneself for the purpose of nurturing one's own or another's spiritual growth. So I now stop hating and I begin to energize myself toward the person I've hated for the good of that person's growth. It's not a passive thing to forgive, it's an active one. When Christ forgave me, he called me into the process of change. And he gave me his Spirit in order that I might grow. Jesus not only saved me and forgave me, but he became part with me in my process of change. And that indeed is what we need to do with people in our own lives who've hurt us deeply. Of course, there are some people who've hurt us that are already dead or that aren't reachable in terms of letting them know that we've forgiven them. Then we have to simply forgive them in order that we might be free of the need to stay bitter. And the last of those five steps comes out of my own experience. I don't think I've ever read it anywhere. It says, raise up the hurtful memories as memorials to the healing instead of memorials to the hurt. Raise up the hurtful memories as memorials to the healing instead of memorials to the hurt. Lots of people say things like, I can forgive, but I can never forget. Now, God isn't in the business, I don't believe, of eradicating memory. He's in the business of converting memory from being a negative, destructive force into a constructive force. The lady school teacher who hurt me so badly when I was a little boy and who left me so angry and hurt had the same name as a big transport company. And as a young adult, as I would drive on the roadways to go preach somewhere, I would see this transport truck with her name blazed across the front. And it would stir up so much rage in me that if I was on my own, I would often burst into tears. When I dealt with the forgiveness issue, I knew I was going to run into those trucks again. And I wondered how I was going to cope with them. And I decided that so much freedom and so much wholeness and so much new life had come to me through the act of forgiveness that the next time I saw that name, I would raise it up as a memorial to the healing. And I have never done anything that's worked so good as that. It really was a beautiful experience and still is. In fact, when I used to meet nice people with the same name, I used to forget it about 3 seconds after I was introduced to them, but now it sticks in my mind as a memorial to the healing or the wholeness. What about some of the bad memories in your experience? And some of us in Christian work have had some pretty rugged experiences. If you've worked for a committee, you've probably had some rugged experiences. If you've been a pastor in a church working with a group of elders, you've probably had some pretty rough experiences. And sometimes when you meet some of those blokes, there's sort of a knot ties itself in your stomach, or you cross the other side of the street and hope he doesn't see you, because you still haven't quite dealt with that. But it's a wonderful thing when a memory of a negative event becomes a milestone, reminding you how far you've come, and not a tombstone reminding you of the pain. We need to ensure the continuation of the process. How do I stay a whole person? What can I as a counselor say to you as an evangelist that will contribute to your wholeness as a person? I list 3 things. The first of them is avoid burnout. And I've suggested a few ways with which you might avoid burnout, believe it or not. One is by rejecting guilt as a valid motivation. Don't do things because you feel guilty. There's a beautiful secular book written that you all should read. It's called How to Say No Without Feeling Guilty. It's on self-assertiveness. You ought to read that. Don't do things out of a guilt motivation. The second way to avoid burnout is to accept responsibility for your faithfulness, not the results of your ministry. Accept responsibility for your faithfulness, not for the results of your ministry. Do you see the difference? When I first started to counsel, it worried me to death if people didn't change. And then I realized that God had called me to give 100% to everything I did for that hour. And when that hour was over, the business of change was between them and God. And I can counsel, and I say this to you humbly, I can counsel 7 or 8 people a day, and often do, walk the 100 yards between my office and home and forget the day's work. Not because I'm not interested in my work, but because I have learned I am no longer responsible for change. You're not responsible, brothers, for results. You're responsible to be faithful. I had a missionary say to me recently, "Graham, I am terrified of deputation work because I cannot honestly say that in the last 3 years there's been one convert in our work. How can I go out and do deputation work in the churches that have supported me without telling thrilling stories of conversions?" And I said to them, go home and share with your church that as far as you've been able, you've been faithful to God who called you. And He has been faithful to you. You have no other, no greater responsibility than that. If you carry responsibility for results, you will burn out. Nothing surer. Thirdly, delegate tasks that are important but not prime functions. Build a team of people around you, even lay people who you can trust and love, and let them carry some of the tasks that you've carried in the past. Don't try to do everything. Fourthly, recognize the signs of burnout. And I've listed a few here. I don't know if we'll have time for you to write them down. First one is weariness all the time. If you are tired all the time, that may well be a sign of burnout. Not meant to be tired all the time. Might be a sign if you're not eating properly either, but It could be the sign of burnout. Waking up every morning with a headache is another fairly common sign of burnout. Insomnia. Ever had the experience of laying down to go to sleep and your brain puts itself into top gear? Overdrive. Last night? Right. The fourth one is many minor illnesses. Getting sick all the time. The fifth one is loss of enthusiasm. The things that really used to turn you on for God, or for that matter, turn you on for anything, don't anymore. That's right, that too. Feeling paranoid, feeling everybody's against you. That's a good sign of burnout. When you start to feel that your committee's gunning for you, it's time to stop and think about where you're at. Might be time to sack your committee too. The next one is chest and stomach pains are often a sign of burnout. This one will worry you. Loss of memory. Some of you are just about in flames with burnout, I can see from here. Loss of memory. And the next one is emotional fragility. When I start to feel very emotional and I burst into tears at the drop of a hat. Okay, that's burnout. The fifth step in avoiding burnout is by taking steps to control circumstances rather than being controlled by them. I have to have a secretary taking appointments or I would not be alive today. I have to have someone who can say, no, he can't speak to you today. Now, I'm fortunate I can do that. Some of you can't. But you have to learn some way or other of controlling the circumstances. If you live by other people's demands, then you're courting burnout. So the first important step in ensuring that you continue to walk the path of wholeness is to avoid burnout. The second one is to attend to relationships. Attend to relationships. Some of you may need to go home and do some work on the most important relationships in your life. Preachers are in danger of preaching ideals about love and marriage so often that they leave little time to live them out. Most times, and I'm just sorry she's not here today, but most times now that I go to speak at a conference, my wife comes. In fact, she almost insists in coming to make sure I'm honest. So she says, it's so easy for you preachers to get out away from home and say a whole lot of idealistic things you never live out. And I quoted the little boy before, and I quote him again. Dad was a distant standing on the other side of a huge credibility gap between what he preached about family life and what he was willing to do about it. Many of our closest relationships may need to be repaired and rebuilt. Time may need to be spent with that little son. Communication open up with that teenager. We may need to admit that there is a credibility gap between what we preach and what is really happening in our home. I know that our wives are called to share our lives, and that may involve them in some degree of self-sacrifice as it does us. But do not forget that just as we value the rewards we see as a result of our ministry, they need to be rewarded by love and understanding and time and sensitivity. I wonder how long it is since you guys have sat down with your wife and said, honey, I've got an hour. I just want you to talk about anything that's on your heart, and I promise not to sleep, switch on the telly, or pick up the paper for this next hour. You can take roses to your wife, you can take chocolates, you can do what you like, but I guarantee there's no better way of telling you you love her than by giving her an hour to listen to her. And when I say listen, I mean look her in the eyeballs and listen. And many of us are too busy, too preoccupied, too caught up in our own work and importance often to do that. We may need to work on relationships. And the third thing is we may need to develop a plan for recreation. I live at the Elkanah Christian Community and I share my life with other families. And when I turned 40 a few years ago, the community presented me with a horse. A 5-month-old horse. And they all drove home and left me holding this filly. I had nowhere to put her. In fact, I remember building a paddock the next day and Bruce McIntosh or someone came by and said, "You're building a paddock for your horse?" I said, "No, this is for my wife. The horse is in the bedroom." But the horse grew up and now she's just a great reason for me to have some recreation on a Friday morning. And you ought to find some way to recreate. I spent 15 years as a Christian worker thinking it was unspiritual to have a day off. I used to think availability and spirituality were the same thing. And for 15 years I sinned against my body, against my family, and against God. And I want to encourage you to make sure you find time for recreation. You might need to plan for it. Brothers, I know what burnout is. Some years ago I lost my voice. I woke up one morning and I didn't have a voice. And I went through weeks of that, a very deep depression, and thinking my ministry was ended, and that was a pretty heavy struggle. I even thought God had let me down. But I know now that I had failed Him and my family and my work by mistaking sweat and toil for a spiritual walk with God. And I offered all the excuses that some of you offer, like, "I'm booked up years ahead. I'm the only person who does that sort of work. If I don't accept this mission, who will?" Our real fear is that someone else will. I've used all those excuses. None of them helped. If it had not been for the beautiful healing ministry of my wife Julie during that dark time and the Holy Spirit's application of the story of Elijah, I dare not think where I might have been today. The story of Elijah is an exciting story. I wish I had time to spend all day on it. In fact, I wish I had a couple more sessions. But the story of Elijah is a magnificent story. And I want to share it with just briefly an outline that might help you. Elijah came to his burnout experience through physical and spiritual exhaustion. He was driven on by his zeal for God, by his conviction that he was God's servant, as well as by some screwy thinking about being the only one left who had not bowed the knee to Baal. He came through his greatest triumph on Mount Carmel. He saw the overthrow of the prophets of Baal and he witnessed the breaking of the drought. Then he heard that Jezebel was out to cut his throat from ear to ear. And he sat under a tree and he sobbed, "It's enough, Lord, take away my life. I am no better than my fathers." Isn't that a beautiful picture of depression? Despair, depression and guilt crowd around him. All he wants to do is to die. But it's what happens next that changed my life and changed my whole perspective on Christian life and Christian living. And I want to just run through 9 things that happen in this story. Just write them down. You can preach a sermon on them sometime. You probably have many times. Number 1, God gave him a long sleep. Wasn't that good? Elijah was burnt out, so God said, "Lay down under this tree, Elijah, and go to sleep." Some of you need a sleep. Some of you look as if you need a sleep. And then after he'd slept for a while, he woke him up and gave him the best Devonshire tea he'd ever seen in his life. It was so good that he only had 2 doses of it, and he went for 40 days and 40 nights on the strength of it. That's some scorn, isn't it? He gave him a good meal. Some of us need to take time out to eat properly. And then he took him on a mountain holiday. I don't know whether you realize it, but Marysville's up in the hills, and that's a great place for a mountain holiday. But he took him on a mountain holiday, took him right away out of the scene and gave him a break. Some of you might need a sabbatical, might need a rest, might need to get right away from it for a while, might need to stop preaching sermons for a while and start to get a new perspective on your ministry. And then fourthly, and this is really important, God at least 3 times, and probably many more than 3 times, listened to Elijah's dysfunctional thinking. Dysfunctional thinking. Elijah kept saying, God, I am jealous for you, etc., 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 and I am the only one left. Now, God knew that there were 7,000 others, wasn't it? 7,000? He never ever told him right till the end. That's interesting, isn't it? But he listened to his dysfunctional thinking. One of the things that causes burnout is that we think wrongly. I'm the only evangelist who can do the job. If I, as a pastor, don't chair this meeting, then nobody else will do it properly. And that's dysfunctional thinking. That's making ourselves more important than we really are. And God listened to his dysfunctional thinking. And then fifthly, he revealed himself to Elijah in a still small voice. Remember, he went past in an earthquake and a fire and a strong wind, and Elijah didn't see him in those things. When we're depressed, we're never impressed by demonstrations of power. We never get excited about reading about people getting converted when we're depressed. So he finally came to him in a still small voice. And then sixthly, he gave him 3 new ministries. How's that? He restored him. He ministered to him. And then he said, you're not finished, Elijah. I'll give you 3 new jobs. And then he corrects his dysfunctional thinking and reminds Elijah that there are 7,000 others who have not bowed the knee to the prophet Baal. So that would be a big help. He doesn't have to labour under that problem anymore. Never was a real problem, but it was real to Elijah. And then, eighth, he alerts him to the fact that he's not indispensable. That was good. He told him to go and appoint someone to take his place. And he said to Elijah, there'll come a day, Elijah, when you're gone, and it won't make any difference. Some years ago, about 3 years ago, I decided to resign off a few committee meetings. And I resigned off a heap of them. Do you know what the saddest and most discouraging thing about that was? 12 months later, they were all going perfectly well. And I wasn't so indispensable after all. And the last one is, he sent Elijah back the way he'd come. Back into the fray with a new attitude, a new sense of God's restoration. Some new thinking, and 3 brand new ministries to get on with. My brothers and sisters, I return to the definition of wholeness and encourage you to deal with negative emotions and thoughts that exercise authority over you. Be whole men and women, free to live and love as well as preach.